Let's turn these here. The Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. We have some bills on the agenda today that the senators are not on the committee. But I don't see anyone here. I think I'm the only one who's here that has a bill on the agenda, so I guess we'll start with me.
I'll listen to you, Senator.
Great.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'll start with the mental health bill.
Okay.
Madam Chair and committee, the mental health bill, the governor's mental health bill, is actually not physically present in our committee today, so our plan was just to take testimony and then to take any amendments and act on the bill tomorrow. So with that, I will turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Wes Koistra, who will begin, will take us on a little overview of the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Wes Koistra. I'm from the Department of Human Services. The governor first introduced his mental health initiative last session. And last session, we did make some limited progress. There was some one-time funding for crisis. There were rate increases that were targeted towards certain psychiatry services. We received startup funds for performance measurement system, outcome measurement system, and for psychiatric bed tracking, which is a significant need given the issues of emergency rooms and psychiatric beds today. But many of the proposals and the investments in the governor's initiative last year were not passed. So we brought the initiative back this year. We've made some changes to it. We've continued to work with stakeholders throughout the summer, and we have hopes of a more complete acknowledgement of the tremendous need to improve access to effective mental health services. I need to stress that this initiative is not a collection of ideas formulated in a back room of the state agency. It really does represent the work and ideas of many people and organizations, including individuals with mental illness, families, organizations that represent people with mental illness, service providers, clinicians, healthcare purchasers, educators, counties, and state agencies. These people and organizations participated in the Mental Health Action Group. I think you'll be hearing testimony later from Gary Cunningham, who was a co-chair of that group. And this group was voluntarily formed in the fall of 2003. And has been meeting regularly since that time to bring good ideas to action, ideas that will improve access to effective treatment and services that are needed by children and adults with mental illness. These meetings, I will say, have been attended in full throughout the 3 years. There was full attendance in the first meeting, and the attendance did not go down when we met last time. This proposal calls for significant new mental health investments, and if passed, mental health services will benefit from over $120 million of new investments over 4 years. These investments and policy proposals are based on a set of principles and on the belief that mental illness is a disease of the brain, and mental health treatment should be integrated into the mainstream of the healthcare delivery system, that mental health treatment needs to be provided early on the onset, at the onset of symptoms, and provide with the same rigor and urgency as other healthcare diseases, that mental health treatment needs to be disciplined in focusing on what is proven to be most effective, on what works for the patient, and that mental health care must be integrated with other healthcare services, and healthcare must be coordinated with social services such as housing and employment. We must respond to people's needs in whole cloth. We cannot artificially separate mental health care from other health care. We cannot separate health care from social service needs. It doesn't work, and our current system is proof of that. But even the best treatment approaches have little value if they cannot be accessed. People should not have to become disabled before mental health treatment is provided. It is not the way healthcare is approached with other diseases, and mental illness should not be treated differently. So with this initiative, we want to invest in improving service access so that the right service is provided at the right time in the right location. And with this initiative, we are applying the objectives of mental health parity to our own public-funded healthcare system. There are three primary components of the mental health initiative. First is to establish a common, comprehensive mental health benefit set across all public programs. Over recent years, we've expanded the medical assistance mental health benefits set so that it now includes many of the evidence-based practices that have been identified by national experts. However, the mental health benefit sets for general assistance medical care and Minnesota care are limited. They do not include such services as assertive community treatment, intensive residential treatment, crisis services, children's residential treatment, and care coordination. People with health coverage under these programs, like those that are uninsured or underinsured by commercial products, rely on county-funded services that are limited by the availability of funds and by the varying commitments of each county. This proposal calls for general assistance medical care and Minnesota care to provide the same benefits as medical assistance, so that anyone who is eligible for coverage can receive the services they need, and the coverage is not limited by capped grant funds. The model benefit is funded through a combination of new funds and grant transfers from counties to the state's health care programs. These transfers are client-specific, and this is a really important point of the bill. The transfers are based upon client-specific data and will be equal to the cost of services that will be moved from the responsibility of the county to the responsibility of the health care programs. The bill states that the transfer has to be equal to that value, and there is settle-up language in there that says if the transfer exceeds that value, we need to return those funds to counties through grants. Grants will not be withheld from counties unless service obligations are lessened and transferred in an equal amount. The second primary component of the bill is to integrate mental health treatment to the mainstream of the healthcare delivery system and to ensure that healthcare is closely coordinated with social services. Integration of physical and mental health care provides more timely access to treatment and preventative care, more informed treatment, and treatment that better addresses the needs of the whole person. It simply provides for better health outcomes. It's been shown that models that treat physical and mental health problems in isolation fail to treat either optimally. People with mental illness tend to have higher rates of other diseases, including diabetes, hypertension, and cancer, than the general population. People with healthcare diseases have higher rates of mental illness, often caused by stressors associated with their condition. People with mental illness have less access to preventative health care. Studies have shown that physical health complaints of people with mental illness are often ignored by the medical clinicians, who inappropriately attribute the complaints to the patient's mental illness. Still, most people access mental health services in primary care settings. 80% of all psychotropic medications for adults and children are prescribed by primary care physicians. Over 60% of the children are prescribed these medications absent any consultation with a mental health professional. This is not what we mean by integration. The most telling statistic is that people with mental illness, on average, live 25 years less than the general population. That is an indicator that health care is not delivered appropriately to people with mental illness. This proposal promotes the development of treatment models that address the whole needs of the individual. It calls for the development of health care and social service partnerships that integrate mental health care with physical health care and ensures coordination of health care with social services. These service networks will be initiated through a consumer-driven RFP process. The language requires us to consult with consumers and consumer representatives to develop the RFP criteria. It will require that social services and health partnerships demonstrate how services will be integrated and coordinated at both the individual and systems level. This requires willing partners, another important aspect of the bill. We are not requiring counties and regions to participate. The number of RFP respondents will be limited, and if a county is not ready to do this, they will not be required to submit a request for to respond to the request for proposal. Likewise, people with mental illness will have the opportunity to choose if they want to enroll in the integrated network. In response to consumer concerns, this year we've changed the proposal to allow consumers to opt out without cause. So there is choice at both the county level, there's choice at the consumer level. The development of these networks is a significant reform because integrated care has repeatedly been shown to improve the health outcomes of people with mental illness across all health care needs, including mental health. Lack of coordination across systems of care has proven over and over to delay or restrict needed treatment and to deliver poor outcomes. The integrated networks will offer a new approach to care that's based on partnerships between healthcare and social services. The design will benefit from the input of consumers and families and will focus on improvements to access, quality, and accountability. This focus will be demonstrated in the three critical stages of the RFP design, of enforceable contract standards — we have to be better purchasers of healthcare, that's part of this proposal — and through evaluation provisions that we have in the bill. Consumer appeal provisions for integrated services will be significantly more robust than what is available today under the fee-for-service system. Funding is also requested for additional managed care ombudsman staff to assist consumers with service concerns. This proposal stresses the importance of case management and care coordination. Case management and care coordination are key to the integration of services across systems of care. Effective case management is essential to the delivery of social services, to achieving an integrated healthcare system, and to communication across systems of care. We have worked with counties and we've worked with stakeholder groups to say what will be the responsibility of counties, what will be the responsibility of the health integrated services networks. But the most important column is what is the one that says, where do these systems have to communicate with each other? Let me mention that while we're trying to strengthen case management and care coordination functions in this bill, we are seriously concerned about the loss of federal case management revenues. This concern is represented in another governor's proposal requesting $40 million to be made available to offset potential federal revenue losses. The final component of this proposal is to invest to develop and support an effective mental health infrastructure. Again, we can create a beautifully designed system, but if the services are not available, it will fail people with mental illness. So we want an infrastructure that can better respond to the needs of both the insured and the uninsured. Counties and the state are uniquely positioned to be the safety net for people with mental illness. That's not necessarily the case with other healthcare diseases. In other healthcare diseases, uncompensated care often becomes the responsibility of hospitals. In the mental health system, it is the counties and the state who share the responsibility for people who are underinsured or uninsured. So we have a number of investments. Most of these are targeted to people who are underinsured or uninsured, and these are figures over a four-year period of time. $46 million to shore up school-based mental health services infrastructure for uninsured and underinsured children. We have lost $40 million a year in federal revenue that went to family services collaboratives and children's mental health collaboratives. This essentially buys back about one-third of that and targets these funds to the most critical clinical services and support services. $28 million to expand mental health crisis intervention and stabilization infrastructure. There was an article in today's paper about a patient flow study that spoke that the major reason for the emergency department overuse and the lack of psychiatric beds was a lack of community services, and it specifically mentioned crisis services. This investment is intended to develop a crisis infrastructure statewide. We are asking for $300,000 to continue the monitoring and tracking of the availability of psychiatric beds and to continue the creation of a system for measuring mental health service outcomes. In the children's area, we already have the outcome system being piloted in over 30 counties. We're asking for $12.5 million over 4 years to expand the application of evidence-based practices and best practices, to expand the availability of assertive community treatment teams, to expand co-location models where primary care physicians are in the same settings as mental health professionals so they can consult with one another and better integrate the care. And another example would be to develop more co-occurring mental illness and chemical dependency treatment models, because we know that for individuals with serious and persistent mental illness, nearly 60% of those individuals also have a chemical dependency issue. $8.5 million is proposed to extend mental health rate increases. As I mentioned, we approved rate increases in 2006, but we want to expand these to other providers such as children's therapeutic services and support providers and adult rehabilitative mental health service medication education activities. And then $7.5 million to develop capacity to address mental health needs of other specialty populations. We need to equip Minnesota to better address the needs of people with low incidence illnesses that we do not have services developed for, such as attachment disorders, childhood trauma, and eating disorders. We also need to better address culturally specific needs of people with racial and ethnic minorities. Minnesota is becoming more diverse, and our service system is not addressing the cultural competency needs of many of the populations we need to better serve. And then over $10 million is added to expand access to a ranging of housing with service options. In addition to this, the bill makes changes to the county share for regional treatment center costs. Currently, the county share is 20% for regional treatment center stays for people with mental illness. This does not, by the way, apply to people who are committed as mentally ill and dangerous. It does not apply to the people in the sex offender program. I'm talking about people who are committed to regional treatment centers as mentally ill. It's currently 20%. What this bill does is it changes the first 30 days to zero, and it changes after 60 days to, it raises the county share to 50%. This is intended to be a financial incentive that says we understand that when people enter the regional treatment centers, it's because there's legitimate hospital needs. Generally, people stabilize after 60 days. And again, we're finding that people are having longer lengths of stay in the regional treatment center, not due to need for hospitalization, but due to the lack of community services. And we feel like in this proposal, we're investing up front in the community service piece of it. In addition, we're adding what is called an intensive outpatient benefit that provides services to individuals who now are not able to get that service or have to receive that services through billings across a number of procedure codes, which really, really prevents access. So that's the overview of the bill.
No. So, Madam Chair, I think we could take the testifiers now. And again, just to remind people that might have come in during the presentation, we don't actually have this bill physically in our committee. So we're taking the testimony today, and then we will act on any amendments and act on the bill tomorrow.
Senator Berglund, and would you like to call your witnesses forward? Gary Cunningham, I think, is number one on the list.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senators. Just happy to be here this morning. My name is Gary Cunningham. I'm the CEO of North Point Health and Wellness Center, Minnesota's largest single delivery of community health in North Minneapolis. I also am the Director of Primary Care for Hennepin County. I come here today as the co-chair of the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group. I got involved with this group originally when I was president of the Citizens League, and I stay as co-chair on behalf of the Citizens League. And as you know, the Citizens League has been responsible for bringing forward many changes that have led the state of Minnesota and the nation in changing our public policy, as well as ensuring that we have a high quality of life in our state. This effort of the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group is another effort of the League and a coalition of private and public partners to transform the mental health system in our state. I want to say before I get started that when I first started on this task in 2003, I thought it was going to be a six-month assignment and I'd be done. And here I sit 3 years later working on this issue. Somebody, when I first started and we had to do background research on the issues with regards to the mental health center, and I had wheeled in my office reports stacked 5 feet high of all the various reports and systems changes that have been attempted to change this system. The mental health system in our state is broken. It affects us all. It affects all of us in one way or another, either as family members. It affects us as individuals that have mental health issues. I can't think of one family that we've dealt with at North Point Health and Wellness that hasn't had an overlapping issue within the family of mental health issues. I myself got involved with this issue in part because my own experience in dealing with the Minnesota mental health system with my uncle was who raised me, was committed, who I had to commit at about 20. I was 20 years old at the time, and he had bipolar and was diagnosed with bipolar disease. And I found that this system is wanting, and it remains wanting even today. The Minnesota Mental Health Action Group's members are a diverse group of consumers, family, and advocate organizations, health plans, mental health professionals, hospitals and clinics, health plans, I think I've mentioned that, local government agencies, the Department of Health and Human Services. MHAG receives no public funding and is funded by donations from Minnesota health plans, hospitals, and healthcare organizations. When we began down this road, we identified major problems in the mental health system, and they include a system that is too complicated, inadequate access due to fragmentation, lack of parity, and poor coordination of services, lack of accountability of programs, agencies, and providers, and problems for consumers and families caused by a dysfunctional payment system. From the beginning, the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group has focused on taking action. It has reviewed past studies and reports and identified solutions that were recommended most often in these reports, and has consulted with consumers, family members, advocate groups to find out what solutions were most important to them. Based on this information, we identified the following priorities: integration of medical and mental health care and coordination of services under a single consumer-centered treatment plan, simplification of government programs, improvement of payment methods to reward better mental health care and earlier identification and treatment, clear identification of roles and responsibilities, focused on producing results, and the formation of a public-private partnership. The Minnesota Mental Health Action Group has accomplished much. We have set a common vision and guiding principles for our work. We have developed a model benefit set, convened many consumer forums and focus groups, designed a statewide quality information program, developed recommendations for changing the public program payment system, developed action plans on many other topics ranging from prevention to school-based mental health services. Public and private agencies and mental health organizations have taken action based on these recommendations. A mental health initiative was introduced in 2006, and some of it passed at that time. Today, we are asking the Minnesota legislature to pass the recommendation on the governor's bill on mental health, specifically Senate File 1025. This legislation, and I want to say that we're not unique here in Minnesota. The system throughout the country needs major revision and overhaul. We stand a chance here in Minnesota to be in the forefront of those that are addressing this issue of integrating mental health and primary care in a way that really gets at the issue of serving people with mental health in our state. This is not a partisan issue. This issue is an issue that represents the needs of all of our citizens in the state. We can do better. This legislation is bipartisan in nature and reflects the accumulation of years of careful planning and study conducted by stakeholders throughout the mental health system. It has support by the Minnesota's major mental health consumer, family, and advocacy organization, and has strong support from mental health clinics, providers, hospitals, and health plans. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present my testimony today, and I want you to think about what changes that we can really make in the system applying your vote to ensure that we change this system for the better for all the citizens of our community. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cunningham. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Cunningham, I would just like to add to the comments you made in terms of problems, both in contact personally with family members and also in contact with people I know who work in the mental health system. I would echo some of your the issues you identified in terms of problems we have with our mental health system, which in my opinion, I don't think, if anything, I think we've been going backwards in that area in recent years. I think one of the big problems is that we don't have parity with other forms of health care in terms of insurance coverage and what we require of the private sector. I think we have we're moving away in some cases from a willingness to provide hospitalization for the length of time it's really necessary. We have a lack of psychiatrists available to treat patients, which sometimes causes people to be inappropriately medicated and to go off of medications when because those issues aren't being addressed. And I think we continue to have really poor coordination between the different service providers available, both public and private, and coordination between them. So I'd be very interested in whatever we can do to provide that type of coordination and make the system work better. But I'm concerned that we're putting the dollars where they will be the most useful, directly into patient care and into providing more psychiatry and more making more beds available when they are needed and in the places where they're needed.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I also echo some of your concerns. I think work that we've been doing over the last 3 years clearly speaks to some of the concerns you raised. I believe that the bill, as well as the other work that we're doing offline, not just legislative work, but work between healthcare providers, hospitals, and clinics, are all pointed in the direction to correct some of the systemic dysfunction that we see in the system. This legislation will move us a long way towards being able to create the kind of financial payment system and model and incentives, and also focusing clearly from a consumer center place so that as we're providing care, we're looking at it from the money following the individual as opposed to following the system. Two, it also provides clearly a more rational way of addressing issues in terms of length of stay, in terms of patients' contact with their physicians, be it physicians or psychologists. I run a major mental health center in North Minneapolis, and I can tell you that there is a major shortage, both of psychologists and psychiatrists and nurse practitioners within this field. And I believe that we began one step at a time, and that this bill is one of those steps that we need to make as a state if we're going to change the system.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Prentner-Solon.
Madam Chair and Mr. Cunningham. First of all, I do support this bill. I think it has some concepts in it that are very, very important, and I think it is a step in the right direction. But I share some of the concerns that Senator Olson expresses, and already we find that we have insufficient providers. My concern is that this bill will work for community mental health centers, critical access clinics, and some hospitals, but that it really does not take into account many of the providers that are out there, and that they will have a hard time fitting in, or that the bill will not reach out to include them, and when we need all of the psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers that are out there. So that is my one of my major concerns, and I think it's been a part of why I've had concerns about the case management of the clients also. And so I will be looking for ways in which to include all of the providers.
Madam Chair, Senator Solon.
Yes.
I would say that, over the last 3 years, we've had hundreds of meetings with organizations, provider groups, individuals, all of their input and all of their talent was also at the table when we had these discussions about the mental health system. Now, clearly, you know, when you're making a major change in a major system, not all the things will be addressed at one time. But I think that we need to get started because we can't afford to have another report that sits on the shelf and nothing gets done for people in our community that have mental health issues. And so while I understand and can appreciate your reservations in that hopefully that you can find some way to bridge that, I would say that from all of the work that we've done and all of the people that have participated in this process, that we have had a totally open process and allowed both provider organizations, organizations that represent both counties and physician groups as well as psychiatrists and psychologists. We've had a plethora of individuals participate in this process, and this is the best thinking. It's the best possible chance to change the system that has been, for the most part, very dysfunctional for people that have to use it. So that would be my answer, and I would hope that clearly sitting in your position that you could make some recommendations that might strengthen the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll call the next witness, Sue Hansen from NAMI. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hansen.
Madam Chair.
Pull it a little bit closer, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sue Hansen. I'm chair of the NAMI Minnesota Legislative Committee, and I'm also on their board of directors. Most importantly, I am the parent of a 32-year-old man with schizophrenia. Consequently, I have firsthand experience on a few of the areas that are included in this bill. I am here today to speak in favor of the governor's mental health initiative. Like so many other organizations, NAMI has been actively involved in MHAG since its inception, so we feel a certain ownership over this proposal. A little over a week ago, over 500 people from around the state gathered here at the Capitol to show their support for investing in mental health. The message was very clear. The time to invest in mental health is now. And to be very blunt, we are tired of waiting. First, NAMI is very excited about the investments that are contained in this bill, ensuring that our children's mental health and family service collaboratives continue to support children, that support for services that treat eating disorders, trauma, attachment disorders, and which help people from specific cultures access mental health care are all critical issues. Also, without stable housing, we know that recovery is nearly impossible. NAMI is particularly supportive of the infusion of funds for crisis services for both adults and children. We must invest in crisis teams if we're going to address the criminalization of mental illness and the overcrowded emergency departments. A NAMI member whose 21-year-old son has Asperger's syndrome put it this way, and I'd like to quote her. "Our son's depression was so severe that he became suicidal. I hardly remember the process, but our call for help was answered by the services of East Metro Adult Crisis Stabilization. Within hours, they helped Paul receive treatment through Ramsey County Mental Health, which he continues today. I truly cannot imagine what our life would be without that crisis call being answered." One of the longest and most intense discussions that the legislative committee at NAMI has had is over case management. It definitely depends on where you live and who your case manager is. Sometimes people have good case managers, sometimes not. Sometimes case managers have had training, sometimes not. My own son was in and out of a group home over a period of almost 4 years. During one of those stays, which was for about 18 months, he physically saw his case manager twice. Now, this is a man with schizophrenia who believes he is God, both on and off medication. I assure you that two visits in 18 months is not enough. One of the members of the legislative committee that I chair
had to inform her son's case manager about ACT teams, had to explain to that person what they were. It has been very clear in our discussions that there is not coordination of health care and mental health care, and very often there isn't coordination of social services. I assure you, I'm not blaming case managers. Very often their caseloads are huge, and there's only so much time in any given day. But there doesn't seem to be any incentive for the county to lower caseloads or to improve the services, because if someone on medical assistance ends up in the hospital, MA pays. Families have a very difficult time dealing with the county when they don't know what is needed for their family member or themselves. It's very hard to find out who to complain to or to appeal to. In my own case, again, when a case manager didn't file proper paperwork for a 60-90-day report, which is fairly routine, my son's commitment expired, and we lost him to the streets of New Jersey. We did eventually get him back to Minnesota, and I decided to make sure that this didn't happen to someone else. It took me weeks of phoning and talking to many different people at the county to finally get some satisfaction in our case. It might be easier to enforce a contract with a health insurance company than our current option. The last part of the bill that I'd like to speak to is the Integrated Care Network. NAMI has decided to support this section of the bill. There's so much to say about this part of the bill in so little time. I'll try real quickly to lay out some of our hopes for this approach. People's health care and mental health care will be coordinated. Care coordination, much like a medical home model, promotes early intervention, prevention, and coordination. There will be a financial incentive to provide early intervention and community supports. People will get help to connect them to the right mental health providers and treatment. People will have a choice to try something new. We know that there is some concern that the proposal permits voluntary enrollment. NAMI believes very strongly that it is imperative that the integrated care network be voluntary. If the plans put together a good proposal, people will opt in. If people have finally been able to find the help that they need, then they don't have to be a part of this. If they haven't been able to get what they need, they can opt in and try something new. Do we know for sure if this will work? No, but we do know that the current system is not working for a lot of people. We believe that the protections that will be needed can be built in. NAMI urges you to support this important legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Henson. Is there any questions or comments from committee members? Thank you very much. I'll call the next testifier, Bill Conley, and I'll just remind people in the audience and testifiers that we have a list of seven bills in front of us today, and I think we have an hour and a half left or so, and I think Mr. Conley is three of nine testifiers just on this bill. So, Mr. Conley, with that.
Madam Chair, Bill Conley.
Welcome you to the committee.
Representing the Mental Health Consumer Survivor Network of Minnesota. The Mental Health Consumer Survivor Network likewise was a member of the Mental Health Action Group early on its inception. And to just touch on what Mr. Cunningham talked about, those reports that were delivered to the action group at the beginning, there was a synopsis that was only about 6 inches high that dealt with both the President's New Freedom Commission on Mental Health, the U.S. Surgeon General report that came out in 1999 about a broken system, an extensive survey that the State Advisory Council on Mental Health had put together from town meetings that they had held around the state. And it's not that nobody was getting any positive treatment or even good treatment, but that the system was, in fact, broken. One of the ironies was, as I presented to one of the first meetings of the group, a report entitled Mandate for Action, and that was from 1984 under Governor Perpich. And basically the themes were identical since 1984 on problems that were structural within the system. We do support this bill that you have in front of you. And while many people will note that they support the benefit expansion across general assistance, medical care, and Minnesota care, briefly, just to let you know, one of the differences between a grant program that provides some services and a benefit in a health care program is that the grant program is limited by the dollars appropriated regardless of the need, regardless of the need. But if we have a benefit in a health care program, then it's a forecasted entitlement. And it's about time that mental health services are treated like other illnesses where necessary care is guaranteed based on medical necessity rather than a limited dollar amount. I do want to just mention a couple things about Section 4 of the bill that you have in front of you. And on page 4 and 5 of the bill, it's putting together a process. I know there are concerns about some issues that need to be addressed, but they are explicitly laid out in the language of the bill that they need to be addressed, such as specialty provider networks. We know there is a great concern and a legitimate concern that there are small niche providers that are doing excellent work, and will they be incorporated into a new system? Early identification. Our system has historically been built on a fail-first model. If you get sick enough, if you get committed, then we can provide services for you of a more extensive nature. We want to reverse course on that. And finally, in order to be brief, there will be a start of willing counties, of willing health care providers, starting in January of 2009. Based on recommendations that consumers and their family members will have in designing contracts, and the bill requires that the legislature receive a report before there is any expansion and suggestions on revision. So I think that the dilemma of how to put this together has not been put forward in this legislation without recognizing some of the pitfalls. Briefly on just a comment on, for instance, a lack of hospital beds. One of the problems we have in system redesign is not looking at the bigger picture, and I just want to give you two statistics. At Anoka Regional Treatment Center, we have a waiting list of about 40 people. We have 70 people that are waiting to get out. So if you do the math, part of the problem is not just beds, it's community services to serve people. And then something that was initiated by NAMI, working with the Hospital Association on issues surrounding emergency care and the number of people that were presenting themselves with mental health problems and the dilemma and the wait. In the discussion of that, one of the statistics that came out was just two, although major hospitals, Regions and HCMC, in 2004 had over 4,000 bed days by people who were waiting to be discharged, but there was no place for them to go. So you can't look at these things in isolation, and I think this bill is put forward to try and look at the big picture. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Conley. Mm-hmm. Questions from the committee? Thank you. We'll move on to Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Welcome to the committee.
I'm Will Wilson from the Mental Health Association. The Mental Health Association is co-chair of the Mental Health Legislative Network, and we've been an active participant in the MHAG process. Our mission is to educate, lobby, and advocate for individuals with mental illnesses as they navigate our fragmented mental health system, and our emphasis is on maintaining the rights of individuals and empowering them to reach their own goals. It is our belief that our mental health system is broken and in need of sweeping reform. People with mental illnesses are frequently discouraged by barriers they encounter, and a big part of our work as an association is keeping their spirits up, encouraging them to keep fighting even though the barriers often seem arbitrary and cruel. We believe that the Mental Health Initiative is an important opportunity towards building a mental health system that meets consumers' needs. We believe this bill is worthy of support, and we hope it passes this year. The significant investments in infrastructure are targeted wisely towards shoring up the community-based delivery system. The expansion of mental health benefits in GAMC and Minnesota Care is a significant step towards parity. We also support the provider rate increases, the funding for services to niche populations, and the effort to use evidence-based practices and best practices. Regarding the payment model, we believe it is possible to strike the appropriate balance between county and health plan, between medical and social services, and between consumer and delivery system. No one knows precisely what the final product will look like, but we plan to participate in the consumers forum that will develop the criteria for the RFP of the pilot. During that process, we will push for the best possible outcome for consumers. We do not wish to see social services medicalized. We do not want to see one set of barriers replaced with another. We will advocate that an integrated service model should do no harm through disruption of services, should include strong accountability measures for health plans and counties, and should actually improve the lives of those with mental illnesses. Finally, we are very pleased that consumer participation will be voluntary. Voluntary participation ensures that entities serving people with mental illnesses will continue to respond to consumers' needs, and consumers will be empowered to push for the best care. We hope you pass this bill so we can continue to craft what, in our view, is a rare opportunity to improve our public mental health system. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Questions? Thank you very much. The next testifier is Chris Flatton. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Flatton.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Flatton, and I'm a member of the MHAG Steering Committee. I'm also a member of the State Advisory Council on Mental Health, and I've been co-chair of the consumer work group that we've had with the with MHAG. You've had distributed to you a position statement by the State Advisory Council on Mental Health, in which we unanimously adopted position in support of this mental health initiative. I am one of the persons targeted by this mental health initiative legislation, but I'm one of the lucky ones. I'm smart. I have a good education. I was a National Merit Scholar. And then I got sick. And suddenly, I became one of a population that is severely stigmatized and discriminated against. Doors didn't just close. They slammed in my face. At the same time, as I looked around, I realized that I was luckier than many. And I decided to work towards helping things turn around for those of us with mental illnesses. And I've been doing this for 15 to 20 years now. This three-year process that we've been in isn't perfect, but it's a step in the right direction. We've had players at the table. We've argued with each other. We've compromised. We've vented our exasperations. And we've learned to respect each other. We really have had divergent opinions at the table. We've really worked on this. Last year, some of you may remember that we came to you because the legislation proposed mandatory enrollment, and people were not able to opt out of it. Since then, we've continued to insist that people need to be able at least to opt out if the new system isn't working as well for them as the system that they had had. The legislation currently includes that. That's been a process by which we've come to the table. We've insisted that there are certain points that we think are really important, and I think it shows that that this hasn't been a controlled process, that it really has been a process that has been responsive to the needs of people as we've been able to articulate them and as we've pursued our objectives. I also support this legislation because I went to a conference of 150 mental health consumers last year and spoke to them about the governor's mental health initiative and heard enthusiastic support for the idea that finally people would be treating their mental illnesses as medical problems and not just primarily as social service needs. People who have been in the system for 5 years, people who have been in the system for 30 years, are really tired of being labeled as mental when they have actual medical problems. And so this effort to integrate, which is not perfect and which I personally, when I think about going into a doctor's office, have some concerns about, but still this is an effort to integrate the mental and the physical health care, and it's not going to be comfortable for any of us in the initial stages. So again, hearing the voices of the 150 consumers who really saw this as the the ray of hope in this whole mess of the system that they've been dealing with has made a big difference to me. Well, there are many technical issues in this bill, and but again, I want to say that if there are irresolvable problems in the future, we'll be back. We have, even with the integrated care networks, they're not due for enrollment until January of 2009. We will continue to raise issues, and this process has integrity, and it's one of the most hopeful things I've seen in the last 15 to 20 years. So I encourage you to please pass this legislation. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Flatton. And as a former head nurse of a psychiatric unit, I want to honor you for your continued personal advocacy in this. Thank you very much. Thank you. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, Ms. Flatton, what do you think will make the difference when you go into the physician's office and so that you get heard rather than be labeled as mental and so it, you feel like you're being dismissed?
You know, all of these problems are multifaceted. You know, there are times when I go in, I get very, very good service. But that's because those particular people have had good training or they've had good personal life experiences or they've are just more empathetic or understanding. It's not really possible to control for every single variable in some of these things.
Madam Chair, no, Ms. Flatton, I'm just, you mentioned, though, that you felt some hope, and I was wondering what is it that brings you the hope that you would be that your opinion about what is happening to you would be valued for being able to articulate what your needs are as being a physical illness and not being discounted because you have a diagnosis of a mental illness?
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, I think, basically, I think that the higher degree of education and understanding, the greater visibility about how these, and part of that we're getting to with this bill in terms of the integration and in terms of the general understanding that these all interplay with each other and that it's becoming more acceptable and less stigmatized.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much, Ms. Flatton. Call the next witness, Patricia Siebert. I'll just keep reminding people we're trying to step right along here. Welcome to the committee this morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Patricia Siebert. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Disability Law Center and have been so for over 20 years, mostly working on mental health issues related to community integration and services for people with mental illness diagnoses. I'm also on the MHAG Steering Committee and have been working on these issues now for a long time, as well as the other people have. I wanted to just briefly mention that 20 years ago, the Mental Health Act, Governor Perpich's mental health initiative, was being considered by this body. And the Mental Health Act resulted in core mental health services statewide delivered through the county social service system, and it was an important beginning. Nationally, one of the first states to do that. But what we know now and didn't know then, or at least it wasn't as apparent as it is now, is that it's important to integrate physical and mental health care and treat the whole person. So while it was an important first step, it certainly left gaps. And the mental health initiative before us is an effort to really address some of the gaps that resulted and produce the next big step in making mental health treatment effective in Minnesota. The Disability Law Center supports this effort and will be devoting our resources, as others have mentioned to you already, to iron out all of the issues that we have been discussing and analyzing and working on for some time now. Others have discussed the infrastructure changes that this bill hopefully will begin to address, including incentives for more professionals. I want to talk briefly about two areas. First is the adoption of the comprehensive mental health benefit set across state programs. Many good mental health services are now available to people who are on medical assistance because they're disabled. But unfortunately, other people have to have repeated episodes of mental illness, hit rock bottom repeatedly before they can qualify for medical assistance as a disabled person. So those folks have to really draw down on the county system. One of the really good things that the Comprehensive Mental Health Benefits Set does is enable those people to access those services earlier on and prevent, hopefully, worsening of their mental illnesses. They also won't have to rely on a particular county's funding situation in order to get those services. So it puts the services where they belong in a health care benefit, and it has real potential to assist people in accessing those benefits at an earlier point in their mental illness, and that's extremely important. Secondly, the integrated network demonstration is an important effort. I don't usually get personal when talking mental health policy, but this particular issue is near and dear to my heart. My brother John had a serious mental illness and spent time in and out of our state and community hospitals. 10 years ago, he had complaints about serious back pain, weight loss, noticeably increased stress. He went to the emergency room and was put on the psych ward, taking up, I might add, a bed that somebody who truly had a psychiatric crisis could have used. But the attitude was really, well, he's losing weight. His bipolar disease must be acting up. What else could it be? Even though his community psychiatrist and his family really tried to get him some medical tests, it took quite a bit of effort for that to happen. By the time we found out that he had a virulent form of kidney cancer, he lived for only another 6 weeks, and he was 41 when he died. And I will never forget him telling me, it's a lot better being a cancer patient than a mental patient. So, yes, people who have significant mental illnesses die 25 years earlier than the rest of us. And one of the reasons is we've got the social service system with its mental health services and the Mental Health Act, as we know it now, over here, and we've got the health care over here, and it's very hard still to bridge that. So integrating health care delivery is an important first step to recognizing and treating the whole person. And maybe somewhat in response to your question, Senator Prettner-Solon, about how it makes a difference when you walk into a doctor's office, there are studies out there that show that integrated models, especially where the services are co-located, do show improvement and better outcomes for people. And that's a model I personally am very interested in. So I really think it's important to try this particular demonstration. And people have talked about the commitment to work on the integration of county social services and the health care services, and we will continue to work on that so that it's worked out in a way that makes sense and draws on the county's strengths as well as the health plan's strengths. I also just want to briefly mention that we continue to carry a concern that these plan services be continually responsive to enrollees. The voluntary provisions of the bill give consumers one of the greatest consumer protections there is, the opportunity to choose another option if this one isn't working for them. Other important safeguards include the availability of information on how decisions are made, truly useful data on expenditure of public monies, reporting of the outcomes produced, negative and positive. And I note that these safeguards should be in place not only for the health plans, for the count, but also for the counties to a better degree than they are right now. These concerns will continue to be worked on by myself and by others through the MHAG process and through the RFP process. And we are really hopeful that a meaningful result will make a better health care delivery system for people with mental illnesses. So I urge you to vote in favor of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Siebert. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, and just briefly, Ms. Siebert, I've worked in an integrated mental health and medical facility for the past 22 years, so I understand what you're saying, and I agree with you. I think, though, that over the years, it still required the advocacy on the part of the mental health professional with the family practitioner to take the patient seriously. But what I see is that as we talk more about mental illness and we see it more as a legitimate medical diagnosis, that the stigma stigmatizing of mental illness is beginning to dissipate. So I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next witness is Ron Brand. And we have four witnesses left, so we'll try to keep it to 3 minutes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Ron Brand, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And I'll just make a few brief comments. Some of it will kind of echo what you've heard before, but it's been my pleasure to have been in this position for the past almost 17 years now. And during that time, I have had monthly or every other month meeting with clinical directors from our, you know, from our providers, whom, you know, which are in 120 different locations around the state, or with the child mental health lead people or the people doing special projects within those centers. And it's been a great education. We were also involved with the mental health action group process from the very beginning. I was able to serve on the steering committee and chaired a task group that was called the Fiscal's Dysfunction Group, and also chaired a group that was worked on care coordination or coordination of care and services. So I want to make a few comments about this. The process that led to this bill was probably the most open dialogue, competent, collaborative process that I've experienced in my time. The questions and the problem solving and the demanding our best thinking was really remarkable. And I am grateful for the really hundreds and hundreds of people who were involved in the process with the Department of Human Services and with MHAG. This proposal only is possible because there were a mandate for action, or there was a effort by former Governor Perpich, or many, many years of incremental steps that this body has taken over the years. But I really do believe, and we believe, that this is the next step in modernizing our mental health system. The community, just folks talking around the kitchen table, have come to expect that mental health services will be treated like another health condition. And that's become more of the community norm now. If your sons or daughters had a problem, you would want to be able to access health care, receive medications, receive therapy, and you would want that to occur promptly and not wait until they have failed in order to get the right services. So this proposal really is founded on those principles of let's help people first rather than waiting for them to fail first. Certainly people with more complex problems will need to access social services and other things to wrap around the treatment and to help support the recovery. But that we're seeing this as a primary mental health problem that will benefit from social supports that people have. So therefore, the standard benefit set, or the common benefit set that this proposes, will give the providers the tools they need to do the right service earlier. Too often people wait to get services because reimbursement rates aren't enough to be able to enlist providers, or because the right benefit set isn't available early on in a person's disease or their condition. And so therefore, we want to not have people waiting or falling through the cracks, getting access to services through civil commitment or custody relinquishment or falling into disability. So the infrastructure investments in this are important, and we just urge your support for the bill, and believe that it is a great step, I think, in modernizing our system. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brand. Comments or questions? Thank you very much. Next, we have Barbara Flanagan. Ms. Flanagan, thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, senators, my name is Barbara Flanagan, Barbara H. Flanagan, to distinguish you from our distinguish me from our noted writer in the Star Tribune. And I speak today for the League of Women Voters of Minnesota. I am also the parent of an adult son with serious and persistent mental illness who also happens to be deaf. And for a number of years, I served on the Hennepin County Local Advisory Council, which I chaired and co-chaired several times. I would like to take a slightly different tack, I guess, than many of the speakers who have spoken already, There are certainly very fine things in this bill. But as an advocate for people with serious and persistent mental illness, speaking for the League, which has a position for strongly supporting an array of services which were mandated by the 1987 Act, and particularly giving priority to people with serious and persistent mental illness, the proposals in this bill raise very significant concerns, partly for people, particularly for people with serious and persistent mental illness. I know that there are very severe problems in the system, although I would tend to think, or the League of Women Voters would tend to argue, that most of them are due to consistent underfunding. This would explain, for instance, the lack of supported housing to which people could be discharged from a regional treatment center, for instance, or from an IRS, an intensive residential treatment center, IRT. That's a new term, so I'm not quite familiar with it. Our concern is that unless there is absolutely clear statement in this proposal that services, particularly community support services, that were established by the 1987 law, which are flexible, not time-limited, because mental illness is not time-limited and it fluctuates, and which can do things that are not always reimbursed, either by the ARMS, the mental medical assistance rehab option services, nor would they be reimbursed by contracts with health plans if that were the route that were taken, although some very good programs are now funded in that way, because they're time-limited, number one, and because it wouldn't protect the infrastructure of the, many of the agencies which exist and which have developed expertise in this area. Unless there is a guarantee that some funds, it would once have been state grants and county funding, is kept in the counties to ensure that these agencies can continue, many people would be stranded. They wouldn't come to their appointments, even though they might be very well suited once they got there, because people with very severe mental illness, from a fear of a combination of fear and hesitation, may miss three appointments unless someone like a community support program person goes with them and convinces them that it's all right. We're concerned under capitated care, many of these people would simply not show up in the system unless these very strong support services, which attack isolation, which is a major problem with many people with serious mental illness, and find and support them in housing. One enormous problem is that people, if they find their own housing, the landlord doesn't understand the illness, and they may become non-lease compliant. If they're evicted, it's extraordinarily difficult to get them housing again. And unless there is someone to help work with the landlord in many cases to make sure they are lease compliant, this kind of individualized service, they're not going to succeed in the community. And I would ask you or urge you to please consider this problem in responding to this bill. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Flanagan. Comments from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, I'll call Mark Ronsol.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Ponsol, P-O-N-S-O-L-L-E. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I'm appearing here representing the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and I will make my comments very brief. I understand, Madam Chair, the time is running fast, but first I do need to thank Senator Berglund, who gave me the opportunity to speak as a last-minute add-on, and thank you very much for that, Senator Berglund. I'm here to talk about only one provision of the governor's mental health bill, and that is Section 9. Section 9, and I know you don't have it in front of you, but what it is, it's a child support provision in the mental health bill, and it fundamentally changes the relationship between the counties and the state. I suggest to you that this provision is better dealt with in Senate File 1271, which is Senator Neville's bill, which is a child support bill, and that the discussion and the public policy discussion should be there, and maybe even in the Judiciary Committee. I also believe MICA and AMC have some of the same concerns I have. So that's my first point, is that I think this provision is better dealt with in a child support bill and not a mental health bill. My second point, and I will also be brief on that, is that the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, the elected county attorneys, oppose this change. And as I said, it fundamentally changes the relationship between the county and the state on multiple issues in child support. The county attorneys also believe that this provision would undermine the legal responsibility county attorneys have towards the counties and the responsibility to provide legal advice. We strongly believe that this matter would be better dealt with in Senator Berglund's Senate File 1178, in which she's asking for a more comprehensive study involving the legislature as to the relationship between counties and the state in the entire human services area. And rather than in a targeted change in the fundamental relationship between the counties and the state, is better dealt with in more of a comprehensive approach. So with that in mind, I would ask, and I know it's not in front of you today, but it'll be in front of you tomorrow, that you remove Section 9 of Senate File 1025 and let it be dealt with in the appropriate forum. With that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ponsol. Thank you very much for your testimony today. And we have had a request for one other testifier, Mark McAfee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mark McAfee with AFSCME Council 5. We've been part of the process through recently through the Mental Health Access Group to look at these issues, and we have sat through some of the payment quality meetings, et cetera. I would say a couple of things. First of all, as far as advocating for the mentally ill and low-income people, there's no one that's a stronger advocate than Senator Berglund, and we know that her intentions are very good. I'd just like to say that we keep hearing that the system is broken. And it reminds me of their weapons of mass destruction. I think what's really broken are the folks that face mental illness and need the proper services to go forward. So we don't have any clear evidence yet that the new system will be sound. Under the payment model, where we have issues with this bill is under Section 4. The payment model, we really think, given the fact we've had federal cuts to counties and whether it's case management or other services, a whole array of services, we need to look very carefully before we charge ahead in 09 into these 40% of target groups. So the devil's in the details. The one thing good about it is the projects don't go forward until 09. I really think we need to look hard and at this before we fully implement this in 09. We would prefer that that the sections that would go forward in 09 not be legislated this year. But anyway, I'll stop with that. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Mr. McAfee. Any questions or comments from committee members?
Madam Chair, just a comment. I think that one of the clearest truths that I've heard ring through today is that I think we've done a disservice to the mentally ill by for years trying to force it into a social service model rather than into the medical model. And I've always believed, and I have worked in the medical field, that it should be treated as according to the medical model. That's not to say that it doesn't need the support of social services and community services, but I think that this bill really pulls it forward into the medical model, and I believe that people will get better care and be received with more credibility as a result of it.
Thank you. Are there any other people here to testify?
Madam Chair, then I just like to close with a couple of comments. The first one is that we do have the MINDO project in the metropolitan area, and one of the providers in the MINDO project is Access. Access is managed through UCARE. We have 700 people in that project in the metropolitan area. It was started with the idea of serving people with disabilities, not mental illness. But guess what? Half of the people in that program have a disability and a mental illness. What are the satisfaction rates with that glimpse into the future of how we could integrate mental health and physical health? 99% satisfaction of the participants. Another interesting statistic that they asked was, are you more satisfied or less satisfied with your physician services? 80% said they were equally satisfied or more satisfied with their physician services in the Access Project than they had been previously. So I think we have something to look at that could be a model for where we're trying to go. And I think that the Access Project has provided very good case management services. They have intervened where people were about to lose their housing with landlords. They've done many of the things that people here today who have testified have said they would like to see happen. Then the last thing I'd like to say about the bill is that we have improved it a little bit. We have added a provision that would say that for people who are in mental health recovery, that we will provide supported employment slots through the stage, modeled after the federal Javis-Wagner-O'Day Act, where people with mental illness have been working in supported employment in federal government buildings around the Minnesota area. We know that people who are in recovery with mental health who have a job are much less likely to be hospitalized in the future than people who do not get employment. And so that portion of the bill will set aside a percentage of the janitorial contracts for our state buildings for people who have serious and persistent mental illness. That is an improvement in the bill. So with that, we'll just set this aside, and we'll be acting on this bill tomorrow.
Thank you, Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, are those work opportunities available just in a model program or across the state?
No, what it would be is Department of Administration would negotiate with supported employment providers who provide employment opportunities for people with severe and persistent mental illness. They would negotiate those contracts at the same price that the contracts are being let presently.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your hard work on this bill, Senator Berglund. I want to speak, too, to the idea, particularly because mental health is the field that I come from, too. It's interesting there's many of us on this committee that have, in our own professional lives, been connected with the field of mental health services. My background is nursing. And I just would like to add a little bit to this discussion as it moves forward that this reintegration of the social services with the medical services, to me, is really about recognizing that people are integrated. People are not divided into mentally ill and physical, mental or physical as separate. They are an integrated system that operates together. And one of the things that's frustrated me as an advanced practice nurse in mental health is that division of the person into separate components rather than treating persons holistically. And to me, this speaks more to restoring what nursing really has believed in for a long time, and that is that health care should be provided in a holistic way. So I'm very grateful that this effort to move back towards an integrated process has been engaged. I would just like to add that one of the things that we've been doing in Mankato, the Minnesota State University, is having nursing students who are in their senior year, so they've really been through a lot of the educational programs and are in the high-level integration, using the opportunities to work with persons who are on case management right now in the county as a part of their community health experience. And I hope that as these projects go forward, one of the things that is considered is also the universities, the training programs for the nursing students at the baccalaureate level and advanced practice level need clinical experiences where they practice integrating their physical assessment skills with their mental health assessment skills, design a treatment plan, and carry it out. And we've been doing this now for about 2 years in Mankato. The patient satisfaction rate is very high when they have a nursing student that comes to see them. It is free service. It's service learning to the counties, and it really is a resource that should be embraced rather than resisted.
Thank you, Senator Sharon.
Thank you, members.
Thank you. Senator Berglund.
Senator Higgins still here?
Senator Higgins, are you in the room? Out. She just stepped out.
Senator Sussman here?
Yeah, she was here.
Senator Higgins, I think Senator Salzman is here. Next.
Yep. Yeah, yep. She Senator did. Salzman. She called you.
Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for putting us in today. It's a busy day here at the Capitol. This is my first time before the Health Committee, and I'm here with Senate File 1683. I'm not sure that this committee has really been briefed on what's happening in the East Metro area. On January 19th, the Department of Health issued a press release that identified that PFBAs, which is a chemical that has been it has been used by 3M, was found in the water supply. One of the challenges that has happened is that this is a chemical that has just recently been able to be detected. PFOAs and PFOSs were those chemicals that were found in Oakdale and Lake Elmo earlier, but PFBAs have just recently been able to be identified. And the challenge before us is that we really don't know a lot about PFBAs. So the health department has set a warning, and I do have someone here to testify from the Department of Health on this with more specifics, but we're not here to just talk about that. The immediate issue is that water filters, we're not sure which water filters work to remove PFOAs, PFOSs, and PFBAs from our water supply. And so what's happening right now is that we have water filter companies. I believe in your packet you have examples of where water companies are going around and trying to sell filter systems that we're not sure work. The health department released another news release, which I believe is also in your packet, on March 1st, because originally there was discussion on what kind of filters would work. We're not quite sure if those are working or how long they last. And so this particular bill is a start to look at how we might be able to determine what kind of filters work in removing the chemicals that we are finding in our water. So at this time, I guess I'd like to start with John Stein, who is from the Department of Health, just give some background. And then our city administrator from Woodbury is here as well to just give the city's perspective. This also involves Senator Sieben's district in Cottage Grove and St. Paul Park. So John Stein.
And we need to be very brief.
Absolutely.
We are primarily looking at a justification of the fiscal note.
Yes, thank you.
Madam Chair, John Stein, Director of Environmental Health Division for the Minnesota Department of Health. Just quickly, we put together a draft work plan to accomplish independent testing through an independently verifiable contractor, either the National Science Foundation, the American Water Quality Association, or some other independent oversight body that would contract with a reputable lab to test various forms of water treatment devices. The primary cost involved in doing this work is the analysis of the samples. For these chemical compounds, one sample analysis costs between $300 and $400 at the Minnesota Department of Health's labs. In order to provide a reliable qualitative and quantitative estimate of the effectiveness of these filtration units, we estimate that about 1,200 water samples would be required across a range of between 5 and 10 different types of water filtration devices. And that's what drives the cost. The primary driver of the cost of the study is the cost of analysis of samples and quality control of the sample methodology.
So does the department have a budget, if this bill were passed, that they could show us as to how this $570,000 would be spent?
Madam Chair, yes.
And could you get that to us?
Yes, we can.
Thank you. You can be very brief.
Yes, I will be. Hello, my name is Clint Gridley, City Administrator for the City of Woodbury. Since the PFBA situation arose, we've had a lot of questions from residents about what do I do if I want protection over and above the health advisory level. And that's what this bill does, and we strongly support it. We need to provide consumer information on different types of filter systems, and there are many out there, reverse osmosis, Brita filters, et cetera. And our citizens are asking us on what they should get if they want to have additional protection. And secondly, so that we can give good, sound advice to people. And this will give us the science and the background to give people advice, even if we don't provide additional water treatment from a municipal end. And, again, the City of Woodbury does support this bill.
Any questions?
Madam Chair, is there any other testifiers?
I don't know. Senator Erickson-Ropes, did you have a question?
Yes, I just, this is maybe a larger systems question, but we heard a lot of testimony last night. Many of us are on the committee that heard testimony last night. It's pretty shocking, but, you know, I'm just wondering in terms of the Department of Health or public safety in terms of Minnesota, isn't there any study being done before these huge accidents happen or the crisis hits us in the face? You know, aren't there any, what sort of preventative measures do we have in store? I'm just worried, you know, if this is happening now and all of a sudden we have an emergency on our hands and the citizens are saying, what sort of system do I go to for water protection? We don't have any answers and we start studying the problem in the midst of a crisis. What sort of preventative actions are being taken by the health department or other departments within the state to make sure that we're all safe?
We've just identified.
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson-Ropes, one of the things that's true about this chemical, these chemicals as well as other chemicals, is the science of detection is improving dramatically every year. We are finding more and more chemicals in our environment at lower and lower concentrations, primarily because the science of detecting them is improving. So as we learn of those chemicals' existence, we engage with the Pollution Control Agency, who is the agency responsible for any remedial actions to clean up groundwater in the state, for example. We do actively monitor what is going on at the national level and in other states to look for emerging chemicals of concern. Minnesota is at the forefront of these chemicals being of concern. We are one of about three places in the country where perfluorinated chemical compounds have been disposed of in landfills and other dump sites. So unfortunately, we have the notoriety of being on the front edge of this issue on the national scene. Other chemicals that are produced and disposed of in this state are investigated on an ongoing basis by the Pollution Control Agency. And I'd like to say that we won't find other chemicals of concern in the future, but I think because of the science evolving, this is an area where we will see continued discoveries in the future. And I don't know what that means in terms of risk to human health, but that's what we're committed to investigate with the Pollution Control Agency.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one follow-up question. It seems to me that these particular chemicals have been traced to 3M, and they're the only source of these toxins in Minnesota. And I'm wondering if 3M is going to help kick in some money towards the $570,000 now that we need to look at the study, and then any sort of remediation costs.
Madam Chair and Senator Erickson-Ropes, we have been in discussion with 3M. 3M has done some independent testing of their own of water filtration devices, and we will use their information along with the information that we would gather through this study to validate results. One of the things that we want to be sure is that it's independent research,
yes,
independently conducted by an organization that is not the state of Minnesota and is not a Minnesota-based company. So we have designed our work plan to accomplish that.
Madam Chair, if I can just add one more thing. Now, the thing that the public has asked me is their frustration of not knowing about this. And we don't know this. We don't know answers. How do we respond? And my response to them was I wanted the public to know about this as soon as possible because they have the choice then of if they want to look at filters or bottled water, although the levels that are there now, the health department has have said, are within you know, a healthy level, but we have not set a permanent level. And that's, I think, where the public has a sense of frustration. But we need to be able to let them make the choice.
Mr. Stein, is there any evidence to show that filtration will work?
Madam Chair, yes. In Lake Elmo and Oakdale, activated carbon filtration units that are whole house systems have been tested and applied to private wells, to homes supplied by private wells. They are effective. Samples have been analyzed. What we're curious about in this study is the more smaller point-of-use filtration units, those that are either under your sink or at the point of your faucet, to see how effective they are in terms of removal of these chemical compounds and for how long. So what's within manufacturers' recommendations, will they be effective? We do know, however, that larger filtration systems that cost on the order of $2,000 with a maintenance cost of about $400 a year have been effective at removing perfluorinated compounds in well water.
Any other questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Senator Saltzman, this is perhaps a question for Mr. Stein. I can understand how the constituents in Senator Saltzman's district are concerned and might be confused. And I have to tell you, I'm a little confused by reading one of the press releases that says that filters containing granular activated carbon remove PFCs, including PFBA. Many common water filters contain GAC. So I'm trying to read this and listen to what you just said, and I have to tell you I'm confused. So try again.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, we did our own independent test. We sampled those point-of-use water filters. They do remove PFBA. I wouldn't call our sampling and our testing an independently, rigorous scientific experiment. We did a sufficient number of samples to determine that they, in fact, do eliminate PFCs from the drinking water. The question we have is how long do the filters last? Because what happens within activated carbon is the
the chemicals of concern attach themselves to the molecules within the filter, the activated carbon molecules in the filter. As those sites are used up by the chemicals of concern, they no longer absorb and they break through. So the interest that we're trying to determine is at what point would breakthrough occur, which of the models may work for a longer period of time, which of the models, because as you'll note from one of the suppliers, there's a significant number of alternative water treatment systems available on the market, and we want to get a representative sample across all those types. The only types we tested were point-of-use filters that are commonly available in hardware stores and department stores.
Thank you. And on Senator's
we
point.
We do need to move on. Right. Are there any questions? Mm-hmm. Senator Kretner-Soland.
Madam Chair, I move that the Senate File 1683 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you for the motion. Any discussion? And we will be looking for that budget.
I'll provide it, Madam Chair.
Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. I have before you Senate File 1731, and basically, I will keep this very brief because I know we're on short time, but basically back in 05 with the comprehensive crime bill that we passed, included was the methamphetamine legislation that was very, very good. And inside that legislation, we had the methamphetamine treatment grants, so it was $750,000 each year to counties, five programs that could prove best practices on methamphetamine. And what we are looking for there is different treatment programs dealing with methamphetamine. So there was five programs that were awarded to four different counties. And I have a delete all amendment, Madam Chair, that I'd like to move. So I'm before you today to go into detail.
Senator Rosen has moved the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Any questions? Seeing none, then the A1 amendment, we will vote on it. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Basically, the amendment just includes all the counties that were included in the grant program. And I should say that Faribault and Martin County are joint human services there. So we are just continuing the appropriation for this treatment programs. They were under the Department of Public Safety at the Office of Justice, and the grant manager unfortunately cannot be here today to explain about these programs, but they are having, these counties have been meeting about every 3-4 months, and they actually have a meeting next week to talk about the success of these programs. And they're all individual, they're all different, and they're all being assessed in that manner also. So I would appreciate the continued funding of these programs, and it's a little early to assess them completely on their success. But what this amendment also does is expands the guidelines to these programs from not only methamphetamine but to other substance abuse issues. Because we have found, and as my testifier, Ms. Savick, will mention, that it's not only methamphetamine, it's drug or poly substance abuse addiction. And so
Senator Rosen, you've got a blank appropriation here, and
yes, ma'am.
I'm just trying to, you're trying to continue the programs that were funded during the last biennium as pilots, and those programs were not in the base. Is that
not
am I understanding so far? Am
that's
I with
right.
you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so how much was it that was approved?
The budget came out of the Office of Justice, and it was $750,000 each year back in 05, so it was $1.5 million is what it was approved for those five programs.
So it was $1.5 million for the biennium, and it was one-time money?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yeah.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I guess I'm just wondering, because I wasn't here in 05, if there's something unique about these particular counties, because I know that this is a statewide program. It's our problem. It's a very big problem in my district. Is there something unique about the nature or the extent of the problem in these particular counties that would warrant funding above what other counties are receiving?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, back at the time of the application for this program, all the counties were eligible to apply for this best practices grant program. And so they were awarded from the Department of Justice, the OJP, our Offices of Justice, I should say. And they had to write out a grant, what kind of program they would have. So with me today, I have a program that deals specifically with mothers and their children. The program in Olmsted County is more of a prison-based program dealing with the treatment inside of the jail. Anoka County has another Mothers with Children program. Carlton County, deals with more of the Native American population. So they're all a little bit different, and they are being assessed by the grant manager to see their success. So we wanted a broad spectrum of what's working with methamphetamine and why we need to treat this addiction perhaps a little bit different for each different population.
I was trying to see if different type of treatment program would be more successful. And it was a pilot. It was originally, I think, part of the governor's budget. And so I'm a little amazed that he hasn't put it in his budget this year.
Madam Chair, perhaps that was my fault because I didn't put this in quick enough. But he did give us a meth coordinator, Mr. Chuck Nuremberg. And I'm hoping that he would be the project manager for these programs to make sure that they are showing results, and if there are some programs that are not showing the results that we would like, that they are taken off of this appropriation amount. Madam Chair, I have Ms. Vicki Savick.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, my name is Vicki Savick, and I'm the Social Service Program Manager for Faribault Martin County. We used the money that we were given through the grant to develop a home for moms and their children when the moms were addicted to methamphetamine. What we were seeing is that through child protection, we were seeing a lot of moms come in that were unable to care for their children because of their addiction. They would go off to treatment, and their kids would go into foster care. And there was this separation while they were in treatment. They would get the kids back and still struggle. They weren't making it. So our program developed in a supported living environment where the moms can live for 3 to 18 months. They receive services while at the house from all kinds of different areas. When we started this, we collaborated with people from both counties, and the reception was very good. The treatment center we were working with was Fountain Centers out of Albert Lea, and since we have weekly staff meetings, they not only provide the treatment services for these moms, but they provide a counselor to come to every staff meeting weekly to see how this mother is developing in her whole life, not just with her treatment assignments. We also worked with our developmentally disabled providers, and Rem Heartland was willing to develop a program to staff this house. So their workers staff the house 24 hours a day, so the moms are never alone with their children. They have supervision, and they have some guidance, and they get some services while in the house. The police departments have also been very cooperative to come in with the dogs periodically when we ask them to make sure that nothing is being brought into the house. And all the school districts from both counties got together, and the superintendents agreed that if we had school-aged children in the home with their moms, that for each child, that we would look at that and see if we could provide transportation so that the children would not have to switch school systems during the school year. We have 3 graduates from the program so far who are continuing to get child protection case management follow-up for a year after graduation. While they're in the home, they get help with budgeting. They get help with cooking. They get help with nutrition. They get living skills classes. They also have weekly meetings with a local psychiatrist on relationship issues, because that seems to kick in when you take the drug away. And we also have human service social workers who come in and provide love and logic parenting classes to them. In order to get discharged from this program, they have to exhibit good parenting skills, find a safe place for them and their children to live, find employment, and they work with the Workforce Center. They also work with our skills group from the MFIT program to develop interview skills and things like that while they're in the home. And so far it has been a wonderful program. We have served 14 children and 11 moms since last June. And they're doing very well. One of the issues that our child protection workers now see that I would like you to consider is that when we get child protection cases or investigations going on and we go out to investigate, a lot of times the moms are maybe high on pot or using cocaine, or they're intoxicated and not taking proper care of their children. The worker looks at them and is pretty sure that the mom has also used methamphetamines. But because of the stricter laws and all the things that have changed when you get caught with meth, the moms are refusing to come forward with that and admit to using methamphetamine unless they're caught with it. So we would like to, if the funds are there again, to see it be extended to other drugs also. Thank you.
Are there questions? The three women who have graduated, have they been successful, and how long have they been graduated?
Three of them have graduated. One has been out a month. The other two have been out since last November, and so far they are all very successful. One of them, about 3 weeks after she was discharged from the program, her brother shot a police officer and committed suicide. And rather than relapsing, which she said she normally would have done to deal with the stress, she came back and visited with the staff at Harbor Home, her treatment counselor, and connected with the solid support group that she'd set up while she was living at Harbor Home. So that's a really tremendous success.
Any questions?
Madam Chair, what I'd like to point out about the Harbor Home in Faribault, Martin County, is that the collaboration between not only the counties, but the city, the law enforcement, the different agencies, or social services, it's been truly amazing. It's a wonderful, wonderful home with great success. And because of the 05 law, methamphetamine law, with increased penalties for child endangerment, we are seeing somewhat of a switch to cocaine, although they have been using polydrug addiction. So that's why the reason for the amendment, to include all substance abuse. And I would just like to see these programs continue. They're starting to get their cadence, maybe we have some real results that we can say, yes, this is what's working. Because with methamphetamine and with mothers or with adolescents or different, people that have had different polydrug addictions for years, we need to gear our treatment and our aftercare a little bit more sensitive and more directly to them, to the individual.
Any questions?
Okay. Madam Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 1731 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the health omnibus bill.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Madam Chair, a point of privilege. I know that Senator Lori has a bill up on the agenda today, and one of his witnesses has driven in 3 hours today from my district. I'm wondering if we might be able to hear that.
We will get to him.
Thank you.
Different. Madam Chair, this is, I'd like to take Senate File 196.
Senator Berglund, Senate File 196, Reverse Mortgage Bill. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members of the division, this is a bill that I worked on during the previous legislative session, and it was generated really because of a report that we paid to have done by the University of Minnesota. They were looking at two things. One, how many increased people in our aged cohort would there be that would not be able to afford both their housing and their health care in the future? And the second thing that they were asked to look at was private sector ideas for how we could help people to pay for their long-term care needs in the future. And I have Lynn Blewett here today from the University of Minnesota, who was one of the researchers on the study, and I'd like her to come forward to testify on the bill if she could do that.
Ms. Blewett, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I have a handout. Hello, my name is Lynn Blewett. I'm an associate professor in the School of Public Health, and I'm a director of the State Health Access Data Assistance Center at the university. We work with states looking at access issues using data and to inform policy. We were working with the state of Minnesota on this project to look at the future of Medicaid costs given the increased retirement burden faced by the growing baby boom population. We did a couple of issue briefs, and I'm just handing out one. And if you're interested in more information, I'd be happy to provide that. Our study found that almost 30% of Minnesota's currently age 40 to 69, or approximately 400,000 people, are going to be at risk of not having enough retirement income to pay for their retirement. This is primarily due to low savings rate, concern about unfunded pensions, and this is a significant concern of potential future burden on Medicaid costs. As many of you know, long-term care consumes almost 30% of all Medicaid costs. Medicaid is approximately 25% of state budgets and growing. And so one of the objectives of these studies was to look at how do you keep people in their home for as long as possible, and how do you develop incentives for public-private partnerships for elderly people to use their resources to pay for long-term care insurance. Senate File 196 provides for one of these unique kind of innovative programs that links public-private incentives to use that equity that people have, elderly people have in their homes. Nationally, about 77% of people age 65 and older are homeowners, and 85% own their homes clear and free. They own their own homes. There's a lot of equity. So this provides some incentive for seniors to use that equity to pay for long-term care services in the home and stay off of the Medicaid program for as long as possible. Another study found that 85% of people want to stay in their own home. And so right now, if you're facing a significant if you don't have a lot of cash flow and you need services, you basically have to sell your home and spend down and end on Medicaid. So this program allows seniors to stay in their home and use that equity to pay for long-term care services. One study shows that if only 4% of the eligible population were to participate in a program such as this, it would save the Medicaid program approximately $3.3 billion nationally. There's a lot of money tied up in home equity, about $2 trillion nationally for seniors. So it's a significant resource that could be used effectively and efficiently. Senate File 196 is unique in that it targets seniors, what we call the tweeners. So they're not low enough income to be eligible for Medicaid, but they don't have enough income to really pay for services. So it's that what we call the tweeners that's like right in the middle. And it's basically to keep them off of the Medicaid program for as long as possible. The Senate File 96 has provisions to effectively target spending. One of the concerns, home equity loans are currently available to anybody who qualifies. This program, and one of the concerns is you can use those for anything you want, buying a boat or giving it to your children. And this program targets those tweeners and ties it to a long-term care service plan and goals. So it's not that you only just get the equity, but that you have a service plan that helps you plan for what you need and basically provides for a long-term care service plan. So it effectively targets those resources to home and community-based services. So we think it's a great plan. Our study basically looked at four different financing options. I think this is a unique way to use public-private partnership to develop a program. It's targeted enough to keep focused on those tweeners and protect the financial viability of Medicaid into the future.
Thank you very much, Ms. Blewett. Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Blewett. Could you just quickly give me a hypothetical of a situation where somebody would use this, so I can kind of understand it?
Yeah, so let's say this is targeted to someone who has $150,000 in home equity. So this could be a rural area. The husband got sick, went into the hospital, had to pay the Medicare deductibles, out-of-pocket costs. They started to spend down. They don't have any assets. Their children don't have any cash flow. They could go get a home equity loan, use that. Let's say he was disabled and needed some fixing up of the home in terms of getting around and fixing the bathroom and widening the doors. That could be used to fund that kind of accommodation, and then also be used to figure out what kind of home health service would be provided. So they would go to, I think it's the housing agency, Senator Berglund, it's the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, apply for a loan, be assessed, do they qualify, and then that they would help them sort of arrange for those services.
Madam Chair.
And if I can just add to that, the way this bill is set up to work is because these people have lower home values, a large amount of their equity would be consumed in the closing costs. These kind of loans have high closing costs. They are all backed by the federal government. And the reason they have pretty high closing costs is because people are guaranteed the right to stay in their home as long as they live, regardless of whether they've used up the mortgage amount. So this bill is targeted at those individuals because they could run out of their home equity before their need for service would run out. And what the bill does then is it says that they are automatically eligible for the Alternative Care Grant Program because they have used their own home equity, been responsible, not used it for a vacation, but used it for their health care needs. Then we will be their partner and be there to be the backup for them for the services that they might need.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
So then, Senator Berglund, so then they don't have to sell their house. They can really stay in their house.
They stay in their house until they die or move out of the house.
Okay.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, is there an upper income limit on this, or is there a limit? Did they have to fully finance the house and exhaust the equity in the house? And does anybody then become eligible for Medicaid assistance on these waivered services?
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Solin, the way the federal government loan works, they have to take the whole equity. But the portion of it that they are not using, they do generate interest on. And under this bill, they would then, once they have used that equity that's left after the closing costs, then they would be eligible to get services through the Alternative Care Grant Program.
And Senator Prettner-Solin.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, is there an upper limit, income limit, though, or will this appeal to only people in certain income brackets?
Well, Madam Chair, we did put a provision in the bill that says they have to be eligible for Medicaid within a year. So okay. It's sort of an income asset limit. I mean, it's fairly high, but we don't think that there are a lot of people in these valued homes that have a lot of income and assets to start with. So,
Senator Putner Solon.
So, $156,000 is the maximum limit of the house. Is that it, or they must have at least $156,000 equity?
No,
in the
that's
house.
The limit. Above that, you would not be eligible for this program.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Berglund. If one person ends up dying in a married situation and there's still a spouse left living in the home, does the guarantee allow that spouse to continue living there as well until that the last of the married couple would die, or is it?
Yes.
Senator Berglund.
Senator
Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have just a couple other quick questions. What is the incentive when you talk about we're giving an incentive to engage in a reverse mortgage? Is it an incentive or is it more of a requirement? And what is the incentive?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, this would be entirely voluntary. In areas of the state which are primarily rural, where people have lower valued homes, they're not in the same position that people who live in other parts of the state with higher valued homes are. People who have higher valued homes who want to do this without being involved with the state in any way could, but they have enough so their equity is going to take them through to the end of their life. These homeowners don't. So there's not as much incentive for them to want to take a reverse mortgage out on their home. So we provide an incentive in two ways. One, we help pay some of the closing costs to take away a little bit of that sticker shock on the front end. And the second thing is we make them eligible for the Alternative Care Grant Program when their equity runs out and they need to have continued services. And we do that pretty much without regard to income or assets, whereas otherwise they might not be eligible for the Alternative Care Grant Program.
Senator Olson.
Just one more question then. From a consumer perspective, in terms of how much this loan is costing the person, I can see where it would be a very good deal for someone who ends up taking advantage of running out of the money that's the equity in their home and then the state is helping them. But there may also be people who are paying these closing costs and then something happens to them in a very short period of time. So as compared to a normal loan, what would the interest rate, if you built in the closing costs and so forth, amount to compared to a regular loan?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, maybe I didn't make that clear. This is a reverse mortgage, so you don't pay back the mortgage. You're taking out equity.
Right.
And you get to stay in the house regardless of whether you use up the value of your home. So you're not paying anything back. There are closing costs, and the incentive here in this bill, even if you don't use up your equity, is that we're helping to pay the closing costs.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Well, maybe Senator Berglund, I can talk to you about this afterwards, but I do know that even though I know how reverse mortgages work, but there's still a built-in cost that's built. And so
there are closing costs, and then there is an interest rate that's paid on the amount of the equity that's not being used.
Okay. Members, we do have...
It's all regulated by the federal government.
Members, we do have one additional testifier. At this time, I'd like to call Bonnie Olson forward. Thank you, Ms. Blewett. Is Bonnie Olson here? Bonnie Clark?
Yes.
Okay. Bonnie Clark. Bonnie Clark, you have 62 seconds.
Okay. Well, welcome. Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bonnie Clark, and I represent Reverse Mortgage Counselors, Inc., and we're a nonprofit HUD-approved reverse mortgage agent counseling agency. And I've done reverse mortgages since 1992, so I have started almost with the program. In the 90s, we did a couple of sessions, and then around the year 2000, people really started to get the reverse mortgages. In the last couple years, I've probably done close to 500 counseling sessions. Out of those, probably about two-thirds proceed. You know, some people are just curious, or they find other means, they die, their kids decide to help them, whatever. But about two-thirds. And just the income levels, and this is rural and the city also put together. I didn't separate it out. Out of the 80 people I counseled, and this is from a HUD report I turned in October through December of last year, 64 of the people had incomes that were equal or less than the 50% of the area median income. 11 were 50 to 79% of the area median income. 2 were 80 to 100, and 3 chose not to respond. We counsel people in their homes, their our office, over the phone. I've counseled people in nursing homes where they have used this to go home, along with the help from family and then home health care. They are able to return home. And this is from a HUD AARP study I found. The first reason people use a reverse mortgage is to use it to cover hospital health care costs, to pay for prescription drugs. Second, to repay an existing mortgage. And lots of times I'll have people that have gone out and got a home equity loan because they don't understand the reverse mortgage or they've never heard of it. And then they get the home equity loan, but since they're on a fixed income, they're not capable of paying back the home equity loan. So then they start to go under, and then they come and get talk to us about a reverse mortgage. Tied for third place, reduced burden on children, home improvement, and then to pay property taxes and just to pay for daily expenses of living. Then in a typical counseling session, we go over the figures step by step, many times more than once. We discuss alternatives to a reverse mortgage, moving, selling, what's available for housing. And most of the people that I do talk to, even if they could move, they would not be able to afford a market rate apartment on their income. We discuss other resources that are available in the community, such as the senior linkage line, energy assistance, store-to-door groceries, telephone, home improvement, that type of thing. So we go over the array of social services and different things that are available to them.
Thank you very much, Ms. Clark, for your testimony. Senator Berglund?
So I would move that Senate file
196
be recommended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you. Moving right along, we'll move to Senate File 594. Senator Lori, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senator Lori here with Senate File 594, an Adoption Assistance Program Modification. This is a really straightforward bill in terms of what it does, and I thank you very much for making sure that we were able to make it onto the agenda today, and we will be very brief. Again, because it is very straightforward, it is a fifth category of special needs definitions under the state's Adoption Assistance Program. Adoption assistance is a shared state and federal program, and under Title 4E, and the federal government allows the states to define their own criteria for what constitutes a special need, and the special need would then category would allow an adoptive parent. It would remove some of the barriers that parents may have in terms of stepping up and becoming the permanent home that our foster children are in need of. And so this program would provide financial assistance to the parents through age 18. It would provide a guarantee of medical assistance through age 18. And the fiscal note also mentions and some very critical supports that it also provides in terms of respite care for parents that are having troubles, on occasion, or just a needed break at times, and also child care. So it is a very important change. One thing I will note is that Minnesota is one of only two states in the country that do not have an age-only criteria to make children special needs for adoption assistance programs. And so with that, I will turn it over to Mary Jor, an adoptive parent, for a brief discussion of what adoption assistance has done for her.
Good morning. My name is Mary Jory. I live in Houston, Minnesota with my husband, Doug. We own and farm our for a living. We are the proud parents of four children, one of whom was adopted out of the foster care system. one of my children is also had died of sudden infant death at age 8 months. Okay, adoption assistance is critical to my family. In fact, my husband and I would not have been able to adopt Bree without the financial and medical assistance we receive on her behalf. That may seem heartless, but her medical needs are in a league that we weren't able to support with our farming income. Bree was placed with us in January of 01, and she was placed as our 42nd foster child. She was so battered that her head was shaped like a pumpkin. She receives physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech and language assistance, home health care. She was also involved in the Birth to Three program. Bree has bilateral retinal hemorrhaging, traumatic brain injury, reactive attachment disorder, and nonverbal learning disorder, which is under the umbrella of autism spectrum learning style. As you might imagine, her care is quite costly. Just one pair of orthotics so that she can walk is $1,700. Her therapy appointments cost $350 apiece. That doesn't even scratch the surface of expenses that go into just raising her as one of your children. We love her dearly, but meeting, excuse me, her ongoing needs is, pardon me.
Just take your time. It's okay. Remember, we all work for you. You pay our salary, so take as much time as you need.
My life's work is to be her mother. This is a wonderful bill, wonderful policy to add age 5 into the Minnesota's current definition of special needs. It means that other parents, like my husband and I, can step up and adopt a child right out of the foster care system. It means that an older child doesn't have to face another day in limbo. I don't know anything about politics. I really don't. But I do know about raising broken souls. They need stability. I'm so sorry. I did not expect to fall apart like this. They need role models. They need families. They need brothers and sisters. They need a mom and dad to tuck them in bed at night. The Senate Bill 594 does this, and what they're telling me, I don't know about politics, is that it doesn't cost a lot. This isn't a big financial drain. Please support Senate File 594. There are other children like Bree who need families.
Thank you. Thank you very
much. And we
much.
Thank you so much
sorry.
For the work.
No, you did
we
great.
Thank you also for the work that you do. It's very important.
It is. Mary actually brings up a very good point that I'm happy to be here with a very important bill that really should fit within our fiscal constraints. I mean, over time, we did get a fiscal note this morning. It'll start out at just $1,000 a year of cost, and by
it's a million.
Fiscal year 11, is it nine?
Oh, it's a million.
Nine.
It's a thousand.
Oh, okay.
It's
great.
A thousand.
Yeah.
We're looking for more of those kind of fiscal
right.
notes.
So
and we'll bring them to you.
I'm very pleased to be bringing an important bill that over time will accrue to a $9,000 cost to the state, which I truly hope we can fit within our budget. Yes.
Senator Prettner-Solins.
Senator Laurie brings up the fiscal note, and I'm not sure I understand this. This applies to any child over the age of 5 that would be adopted?
Well, most children that have come through the foster care have other, this is the fifth category of special needs, and children that coming through the foster care system are in the foster care system because of a very difficult and rocky start in life, and most of them qualify under one of the other four special needs, but it's just as a child ages, it becomes harder and harder to find that permanent home, and so by age alone, we feel that there should be a special needs category. And so this is a small number of kids, but a very critical piece of support that we can offer.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Laura, you anticipate by 2011 that there would be less than 11 children that would have need this assistance?
Yes.
Okay. The department, I'm sorry, Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solins.
You could just
introduce
yourself.
My name is Jeanette Wiedemeyer-Bauer. I work for NACAC, the North American Council on Adoptable Children. The department last week indicated that over the next 15 years, they really only expect maybe 40 children to walk through the doors. And this is just one other opportunity beside being a sibling group, which would make you wait, or part of a medical condition that would make you wait. Our older children are waiting longer, and so we're just trying to close a loop for just a few kids.
Okay.
Any other questions? Not Senator Lori?
I would move Senate
Senator Erickson Ropes has a question.
I just want to make a comment and thank Mary Jory, she's from my district, for making the trip up here today to speak to the bill, but then also for the job that you do in the hundreds of foster homes and adoptive homes out there that really open their doors, and it seems an extraordinary child that you have. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yep, and every one of our children is extraordinary. I really hope we can put this together. So I would move Senate File 594 for possible inclusion in the omnibus budget.
You've heard the motion. Those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
I apologize to the other people who are here for the other bills on the agenda today that we didn't finish the agenda. Those bills will be placed at the top of tomorrow's agenda. And with that, the meeting will be adjourned.
All right.